Okay, welcome to the Stage Left Podcast, lifting the veil on the music industry by telling the stories of those with a unique vantage point. The podcast exists to provide free educational content for young musicians entering an increasingly complex industry. So go to thestageleftpodcast.com for all episodes featuring members of Supergrass, Radiohead, Guns N' Roses, Queen, Earth, Wind & Fire, The Zootons, Oasis, Fleetwood Mac and Kraftwerk, who discuss their writing, recording and performing processes, as well as reflective interviews with musicians and producers who've worked on stage and in the studio with the Beatles, Beyonce, Elvis and David Bowie. Today we have a very special episode. We're joined by the acclaimed songwriter Toby Sebastian, who you just heard there, who as well as being an incredible writer and vocalist, starred recently opposite our last guest, Kate Nash, in the brilliant movie Coffee Wars. As well as playing Andrea Bocelli in The Music of Silence, he also played Tristan Martell in Game of Thrones, both of which you'll hear fascinating stories about in today's episode. So it's a pleasure to say that our guest today on the Stage Left Podcast is none other than Toby Sebastian. So Toby, you're midway through a series of shows as we record this. How do you go about choosing set lists? Because that is something I know that many songwriters, right, spend a lot of time musing over. So, you know, how on earth do you go about choosing your set lists?
Shows are going great. We've done two of four. I've never had a few shows this close together, so it's a lovely experience having that euphoria when you get off stage. And instead of normally what I experience is in the morning, there's almost like a moment of sadness. Because it's going to be a while until the next show. It's a lovely feeling waking up in the morning, tired, exhausted, but on a high, a real buzz, and knowing that there's another one coming. So I played Bristol, we played Manchester, and I've got London tomorrow. I've got a sold-out show at Amira in London, and I've got a hometown gig in Oxford on Friday. And the set list question is a good one, really, because it's something I find really difficult. I found it really difficult, particularly this kind of run of shows, because I've got an album that's coming. We don't have a release date for it yet, but I know what songs are going on it, and so it's tricky. There are songs that some people have never heard before, and that is a worry. But at the same time, I know that if I don't seed it now, and if I just play the same set that I played a year ago, then people, there's a risk of people maybe not finding it boring, but I don't want them to come and see me just replicate and play exactly what I played before. You know, I feel like it needs to change, it needs to grow a little bit. So we've added some songs, we've taken a song or two away, but really what we've done is we've tried to sprinkle the new songs, kind of spread them out a little bit, and at the same time try and come in with some sort of bang, a lot of energy. The set varies, really. There are songs where I'm just finger picking on the guitar and singing a ballad, but I want to try and grab people's attention straight away. Whether we achieve that or not is a whole other thing. And then also what we did is my guitarist and I, we switch guitars at times. And so we did find in rehearsals that before we'd start putting the set together, basically every other song, one of us was changing, or every song, one of us was changing a guitar. And it was just ridiculous. It looked, it was so much movement. And I just thought to myself, people are going to be yawning if every single time we keep on, you know, we're guitar guys and we keep on changing our guitars. So we've kind of coordinated that a little bit so that we can both change at the same time.
Just get a third guitar. Like that's the answer. But yeah, there we go. It's that's really interesting. I mean, there's so much more to unpick from that answer. In regards to the rehearsals and going to the shows, what will change between shows? I mean, you, obviously, when this is going out, it's going to be after the show, so there's no spoilers for anyone. But like, is the set list mood dependent? Like, might it be a case that you say, actually, I want to do something different tonight, a different time in the set? Or is it something that you try and structure and stick to for the four shows?
We have a structure. I think I'll probably stick to the structure because we spent a lot of time rehearsing that. So it's kind of like quite a smooth transition between each songs. The only thing that might change that is really a vibe dependent thing is the encore, what goes on the encore. So we have one song that always, that is going to be on the encore, that's been on the encore for the last few shows over the last year. But I mean, this is obviously if people want an encore for starters as well.
I'm sure they
will. Don't always get called back. But if in the event there is an encore and people are shouting for more, there's a song that I may change depending on one, how the mood is, and two, how my voice is faring, really, because it's the there are moments in the set that I'm kind of cursing myself, going like, who wrote this song? And like, who on earth wrote this song? Make it so vocally demanding. It's like, well, you, Toby, you wrote your songs, you have to sing them now. So there's a lot of learning in that respect as well. Like, maybe don't make every single song so challenging that you can barely sing it.
Do you ever arrange the songs so that you're building up to a particularly difficult, you sing obviously a lot of falsetto parts as well, and you're really belting at a high range. Do you ever consider that in your set list, in particular the order of the songs, how your voice gets rested at different points or where it needs to peak, or is it you just
it's definitely on my mind. There hasn't been a lot of that. I'd say that the last couple songs are very demanding, but from the get-go, the songs are pretty tough. I mean, they're fine now. I've done a couple shows and we've had weeks of rehearsal. But if I didn't have the weeks of rehearsal and I went straight into them, I'd absolutely strain my voice. It's funny, I played a little acoustic show in, it's called Golden Slippers. You've probably heard of the kind of acoustic nights. I did one in Soho about, I don't know, it was 6 weeks ago or so. I was invited, very lucky to be invited to come and play. And I had this little set list and I'd kind of, so I went along and I had this song. I've got a song called Don't Lay Your Head Down, which is falsetto and it's very high. I can sing it easily as long as I'm warmed up a little bit. The problem is though with the song is it requires, there's no like oohing or ahhing or testing out your voice before you hit your first note. So you're kind of in. It's very hard to kind of get your bearings as to where you're gonna, you know, it's such a fine line. And so beforehand, I remember my parents came into London to watch it. And my mum said, so what song are you starting with? I said, oh, Don't Lay Your Head Down. She said, is that a good song to come in with? She said, because she knows my songs as well as I do. And I said, what do you mean? She said, it's quite demanding. Wouldn't you want another one? And I was like, mum, I know what I'm doing. Please don't stress me out. Anyway, I come to do it and I just completely missed the note and I'm just wobbling above it, below it, anywhere but on it. It was awful. So next time I will bear what my mum said in mind.
Mums know best, right?
Mums do know best, yeah.
But looking back, when you were signed originally, how do you think that changed your approach to writing, even subconsciously, in any way at all, even if it was just 1%? Do you think when you became a signed artist, anything changed in your mind in regards to your approach to songwriting?
Yeah, I would say it changed quite a lot. I think it's kind of like leveled out now. I think I'd say that, like on reflection, I've taken the best bits of that knowledge now. So although I'm not writing music to try and I'm not trying to write a hit song that will go on radio, even if I don't like the sound of it necessarily, even though I don't do that, I take the bits that I learned, which is how to write songs, structure. When I first was signed, I spent a couple years between London. I left school, I think a year and a half, almost 2 years early for this development deal, which then turned into a kind of a 5-album deal. And I spent time in London and then LA. And then ultimately, in the end, it was Nashville that I kind of recorded this album with this country singer, songwriter and producer. It wasn't a country record. It's just that our worlds kind of worked musically. But before that moment, before working with him, I did have a 2 or 3 year period in London where I was kind of put in with lots of different writers, all lovely people. But the only thing that mattered was to write a hit. There was a lot of time where I wasn't really asked, not in terms of the label, but in terms of writers, there was a lot of time where people didn't ask me, do you like this? You know, There's a lot of that. And no one was necessarily, no one was being like, you know, mean or malicious or anything. I think there was just that they're used, people are used to in that world having artists come in and they've got to achieve something in the day. If they don't achieve something in the day, you might not get another shot. But the irony is that there has to be compromise on both sides. The artist has to, in that situation, you know, you are with a label, unless you've already got a huge fan base, they're investing lots of money and time into you. And it's not too much, I think, for them to ask you to try and come up with something that is slightly commercial, because you've got to sell, you know, you've got to sell some records. But at the same time, you shouldn't compromise or you know, sacrifice your artistic integrity completely. There is a balance, I do think. And then, you know, if you do well through that vehicle or that way, then you open up, you know, the opportunity for yourself to play around with things more and do more of what you want. But I would say that now I've learned loads of great things about writing and structures, and the industry's changing now, of course. So I think I read something the other day, like within 15 seconds, a Spotify editorial playlist or whatever will decide whether your song is worthy or right or something like that, which is quite terrifying. Yeah. But I think that I'm way less conscious of trying to write that number one hit, because I don't think it works like that. You could have the best song in the world and it could be absolutely perfect for radio, but you still need lots of luck, and you also need lots of backing. You also need to love it as well.
Because you've written songs that I think could be international hit, and there's songs that have had millions and millions and millions of streams. But and I spoke to you about it last time we spoke, One Day at a Time, which you said you don't play now anymore, I think, on your set list. Like, that is just what a modern classic that is. What's your memories of writing and recording that song?
So that was a long time ago. I had that song, I think, when I was about 21, I wrote that song. And I wrote it in Oxford, and I worked with a guy. Originally, I worked with a guy called Sam Williams, who produced Supergrass' first record. And I also worked on it a little bit with my older sister Bella. But that was a song, a chorus that I had. I think I'd even had it for years before then. And I kind of, bit by bit, every single year, I'd kind of come back to it. And but yeah, I released that in 2019 on the EP Hamlia that you listen to, and I love that song. In fact, I've never played it live for the band, so maybe I should take a page out of your book and actually do that.
That'd go down so well live. It's so upbeat. It's just everyone would love that. I think that's
yeah, I think you're right.
It's a banging tune. You should get it in the set list. Another great song of yours, Toothpaste Kisses.
You like Toothpaste Kisses? Yes.
That one cuts deep, right?
Yeah, I did. When did I do that? I did that in I think the first, it was the first lockdown. I was in, we'd left, my girlfriend and I had left London temporarily, or I guess, but we didn't know how long it'd be. And so I went home to my family's house in Oxford, and I finished that there. In fact, I wrote that song once again, or I came up with the chorus, didn't finish it, a few years ago. I'd gone out, I was in Spain with my girlfriend, and we'd gone out in her, basically where I grew up a little bit, and also where she grew up. We went out and I was traveling back to England the next day. We were doing long distance at the time. She was going to go to Dubai. And I went downstairs so hungover. I was just really tired. We had a fantastic night with friends. And I got a cup of tea, and I remember singing Toothpaste Kisses with you as I came up the stairs. And so, creatively, there are these weird little bursts, and there's no explaining sometimes for me as to how they come about. But yeah, I think that's what I love about it. They can kind of really surprise you sometimes.
Nice. Going back to the shows you're in the middle of doing right now, what's the balance like between feeling rehearsed and over rehearsed? Like, so at what point do you kind of say, right, we've done enough now? Is it a case that you kind of practice and practice and practice and rehearse until it's kind of ironed out of any potential creases whatsoever? Or do you hold something back for spontaneity? Many artists treat this in a very, very different way, even in the same band. So I know bands that kind of have fallen out because of this, like how much we need to rehearse, right? Like well-known bands. What's your approach? Where at what point do you want to stop rehearsing?
That's a really good question, because I just don't know. I kind of like jump between two trains of thought, really. I feel like I think that it must only make sense to rehearse until it's perfect. That's what one part of my brain feels. But at the same time, my heart says a different thing. So I had a rehearsal, had loads of rehearsals in the last few weeks, but we did a two-set rehearsal, which is the first time we did that. And we did that. We booked it. There's a place in East London called The Promises. We went and booked a room in the Promises Studios. It's a place where loads of people rehearse before tour or before row, or even before recording. We had this kind of room there. Get out of the studio in Bethnal Green, go somewhere else, just try. And also stand in formation. Drums behind me, my guys on the left and right, with me facing a hypothetical audience. And the first time we played it through, I mean, I don't know what the boys think, but the first time we played it through, I thought it was awful. I was going, oh my, this is our last rehearsal. Oh my God. Two rehearsals prior to this, we had sounded amazing. It was really tight. But for me, what I was hearing, and maybe it was just that the sound was set up weirdly, but particularly for my performance as well, I was just like, oh my God, I sound awful. And so after that rehearsal, we then played it one more time, the whole set, another. So we basically played like two and a half hours or something. And the second one was better. But I think after that, I just had to tell myself, Toby, you've done, I don't know, let's say like 10 rehearsals where you've run the entire set and again, and the new songs again. You are so rehearsed. You can't do anymore. Today was just unfortunate. That's and I really had to kind of say to myself, today's rehearsal or sound does not represent where you are or where the band is. And that's really difficult because it can be really scary. You know, the next time you go and play is to a sold out room and people are expecting a better performance, you know, even more and longer in terms of the set. So I think if you asked me before a rehearsal, I would say, rehearse it until it sounds right. If you ask me after I've run the set once and I'm tired, I'm probably saying I just want to go home now and forget about today and get excited about the gig.
Nice. What's the common denominators between like the gigs you most enjoy playing? So what's been in place if you to analyze like all the ones you've most enjoyed and maybe feel most relaxed on stage? What's the common theme between all of them that's allowed that to happen?
To relax, I would say, well, so the funny one, my sister Bella is a wonderful musician as well and actor. She's also a voice coach at Lipper. She's like a bit of a voice master. So I remember talking to her about a year and a half ago before I started gigging properly again, because I knew how demanding the set was. And I said to her, look, there are some things, are there any particular things I should know or warm up? And she taught me kind of a rough warm up to do, gave me a few tips in terms of what you can and can't, what you should and shouldn't do, things to eat or drink or whatever. But she said, so one of the things was do not, like, you don't really want cold drinks before you sing. Icy cold drinks, it's like a muscle. I guess it's like, you know, if you're going to warm up your body before you go and do something sporty or an event or whatever. It'd be no different to an athlete warming up their muscles. You don't want ice on your muscles. And so it's the same with your throat. And so I remember I did a gig, can't remember when it was, probably a year and a half ago, whatever. And afterwards I told her, I said, I was really nervous because it'd been so long since I'd sung. And this was a jump up in terms of how hard it was in terms of the set, vocally demanding. And I said that I found that my voice was doing something that I hadn't experienced before, kind of from nerves, which was, it was kind of like jumping between notes, like hovering. It wasn't like very confident. And I said, look, I didn't have any cold drinks. I just had water. And she said, look, you might find next time that, you know, if you need to have like, want to have like a drink beforehand or go on stage with like a beer or whatever, like, it's far better to have done something to relax yourself a little bit, you know, whether that is to have a drink or to not think about music for for 2 hours prior to the gig, than to kind of think and obsess and be nervous. She was telling me that nerves and anxiety, that is the worst thing for your voice, you know. And you could have a couple glasses of wine, and if you're not nervous, if that means that you're not nervous, that's far greater than being clean and perfect and over rehearsed and prepared and doing vocal warm-ups for 3 hours. So she was saying, you know, being calm and confident is, that's the most important thing. If there was a thing you could ever achieve before a gig, it's that, however you do that. So that's something I've found. It's been hugely, hugely helpful. If I'm relaxed and I'm with people that I love and I don't take it too seriously, if I'm rehearsed and I've done the work, generally, touch wood, that has been what I've experienced. A really enjoyable set. First song, I always find a little nervy because you're kind of, there's levels and things and some things that are happening that you didn't hear in sound check. You don't know what the audience are like. But feeling calm and just taking all the pinch of salt, that's the number one thing for me, I'd have to say. And the second thing is audience, really. Feeling a little bit of a buzz from the audience does wonders for me. I'm sure for lots of artists too. Bristol was a lovely gig. It was a really great crowd. Went to Manchester, and they both had different energies. Both is lovely, but in Manchester, there was so much singing, so much clapping, so much cheering. So if I'm in the middle of a song and people are really singing and I can hear 100 people chanting out the chorus, it does monumental things. It's huge. It's so powerful. And then it basically kind of, that for me, it matches with with this adrenaline rush. And suddenly I start reaching different parts of my voice that I don't normally dare to go to. And it's,
Wow.
you know, it's like a little bit of turbo. There's like another 5% where I can go to. And it's those moments, I think, that we all as performers try and find. Because when you see whoever we love performing or whatever musicians we love, I guess after they've done, I don't know, 500 gigs, they probably achieve that quite often.
Hi there, this is John Wough, the saxophonist with the 1975. And my favorite episode of the Stage Left podcast has to be episode 49 with Bob Rounds. His anecdotes of working as a sideman alongside John Mayer are absolutely fascinating. Go and take a listen.
So James Gandolfini, who played Tony Soprano, used some quite interesting techniques to get himself into the role of Tony if he wasn't really feeling it. So he would, if you know that particular day shoot required him to be quite grumpy, he would deliberately get up at 3 o'clock in the morning and walk, put a stone in his shoe and walk around from 3 o'clock in the morning with a stone in his shoe. So when it came to shooting, he was genuinely grouchy. And obviously, as an actor, you know, and you've been in some major things. What's your philosophy to getting into the role of the character that you are playing?
I think for me it depends on the character. For someone like Amerigo Celli, so that needs to be dealt with huge amounts of sensitivity, and it needs to be very, it's very delicate, because and the only way you can do it, or for me anyway, is to spend time with the person. If you get the opportunity, and if I didn't get the opportunity to spend time with him, then what I would have done, which is what I did anyway, is I just would have, for weeks or however many weeks I had, 6 weeks, I would have just watched as many videos or archives of him as possible. Fortunately for me, what I did have is I had, you know, I had time to spend something like 9 days with him. And so I think in that case, having the time with him meant that I didn't have to be in character, you know, all the time beforehand in the prep. But if I hadn't spent time with him, I would have had to do more of that. I would have had to go more method for sure.
And what was the makeup of those 9 days? Like, what were you actually doing? I mean, was he aware that, you know, was it clear to him that you would be observing him so that you could play him in a role? Was that part of the release? Yeah.
Yeah, he was fully aware. He basically offered. I mean, I asked, I think my agents, if they could ask the producers if I could spend some time with him or at least meet him once. And he kind of came back and said, you know, how many days does Toby want to hang out? Come down to Forza Domami, which is what I did. So I think I came down, had a little kind of Airbnb or whatever, and I spent like, yeah, I think just over a week with him. And so what I did is, I think on the first day I kind of met him and I sat and chatted to him and I chatted to his wife, and we ate. We had 3 meals that day together, breakfast, nice, lunch and dinner. We had some wine. We had a laugh. Then the next day, went for a walk. I just hung out with him. It was quite extraordinary, really. I didn't think that. I kind of found it hard to believe that anyone, even if you were playing them, would give you that much. And he did. And I think what was interesting about it is that he just seemed to actually want to kind of get to know me. It didn't even feel like he wanted me to do the best possible job, which obviously you would. Anyone who's being played by someone else wants it to be as authentic as possible, but he kind of genuinely just—it really felt like he just wanted to meet someone new and talk about music. And so, I think the highlights of that trip of meeting him was one of the days we went up to the vineyard up in the hills, and he kind of disappeared for a bit and came out on a huge stallion and started doing dressage. Oh. In front of me, yeah, as you do, and then he just galloped off into the distance.
Very Andrea Bocelli.
Very Andrea Bocelli. Yeah, quite
amazing. I mean, one thing I really want to ask about this. So, my day job for the last 8 years, I've worked for a sight loss charity called RNIB, which is a national charity for supporting people who are blind or partially sighted. What did you learn about what it might be like for someone, or the social barriers that are constructed for people with sight loss to be able to live the life they want to, having played Andrea Bocelli and actually researched sight loss and some of the challenges that come with that?
Well, he's an anomaly, obviously, because you think about his audience. I think, don't quote me on this, but I think he sold something like 80 million records. Mm. Okay. And I think he was 34 when he hit real success. So that was kind of considered a little bit older than what you would normally be starting out getting successful at. So since he was 34, he's been a kind of a worldwide star, household name. And the fandom, you know, the fans are there. It's crazy. I mean, people love him. He's like this kind of godlike figure, particularly in Italy. But he's incredibly independent. And I think that part of his blindness, I think that has, it's kind of probably driven him, from what I remember him telling me, to be as brilliant as he is. I think from a young age, a lot of people felt like, you know, felt sympathy for him, and he did not want sympathy from anyone. He had sight, some sight in his eyes until about 12, when he was playing football, and then he basically had the ball kicked in his eyes. He lost kind of virtually all of it. So, you know, he used to be able to see shadows and different shades of kind of color, very small amounts. So he had that, and then he lost it all. So that man is incredibly strong and driven, and it'd be hard to find him not smiling or laughing ever. He's just so optimistic.
Did he sing in front of you?
Yes. I said to him that I was a little worried about some of the songs, and he said which ones. So I listed them, and I'm not kidding. He sat down at his grand piano and he played them all.
Nice.
And sang them. It's like 8 songs that I was worried about, because they're all in Italian. And I had a teacher who was teaching me how to come the position of being an opera singer, how to sing like that. And he just basically just broke out into every single one of them. Which one's next? This one. Boom. Off he went again.
I'd be just making up songs, right, as well. I'd like to say, oh, yeah, can you do this one as well? Yeah, can you do this one?
Yeah, I'm trying to do this one. Literally.
Yeah,
literally.
Yeah, just to get into form. One of the things that comes out of the podcast, so you have a lot of young listeners, like preparing, you know, walking into like high pressure environments to perform. The fact you walked into season 5 of Game of Thrones suggests to me that it must have been in your mind that whatever I do here, it's going to be seen by millions of people on the Monday when it's released or whatever it would be. How do you not let that get into your brain? It must be very different to doing something that you think, oh, this could be a show that goes out and does well. It might be seen by a few people, but it's guaranteed when you walk into season 5 of Game of Thrones as a character that this is definitely going to be seen by a lot of people. How did you deal with that in the back of your mind as you were kind of rehearsing and auditioning, et cetera, et cetera?
It was daunting, I think, until the auditioning process was quite scary because I just wanted it so badly. And when I got the role, I was kind of in such disbelief that I just felt nothing but happiness and euphoria. And then it was only when I got there and I saw the scale of the set that it was more nerve-wracking. But I'd have to say that, surprisingly, it wasn't like I had to get through it because I was part of that new world that didn't really last very long. But those actors in kind of In Dawn, a lot of us had never been in Thrones before. We all cast at the same time. So we were all experiencing it. We all shared that. There's a lot of love and support for each other. And so there wasn't a huge amount of nerves. There was clearly pressure, as there would be on any show that you came into that was already a huge worldwide success. But I'd say it's more excitement. And I'd also say that one of the outfits that I wore, I wore an orange outfit at one point, was so itchy that I actually spent probably 99% of my worrying and time and stress trying to walk in it and not look like I was in pain. maybe that was a trick that the costume department thought could help me.
Yeah, stuck something in there. I got to ask, because I watched your death scene earlier, and it's so realistic the way that. So how was that done? How did they do that? Because it looks like exactly, unfortunately, what it would look like.
It's crazy. Green screen. So what they do is they basically kind of stand in this position. And they take I don't know what it's called, but they've got like literally like 50 cameras, and they've got like small cameras, like, you know, photo cameras, and you're basically surrounded by these things, and you stand in a position. So they get like every single millimeter of your body, from your front, back, side, top, bottom. And then, so they've got that image to like kind of play with. And then what they do is you kind of stand in a couple of positions. One, the position you're standing in before I got stabbed. And then the one you're in when you get stabbed. And then they had a stunt guy basically fall flat on his face, because obviously you still need, I think that shot, they still saw me completely. I was kind of speared. And then you just saw my really gammy head just hit, you know, kind of straight onto the floor. So they then had someone who would do that without a mat.
But your gammy head looked exactly like you. That's the unbelievable thing about it. Like, it just looks like how they did it. It's just.
Yeah, that's where the kind of CGI comes in. They spent a fortune, no doubt, on that. Because it's just so real, isn't it?
Great stuff. Now, another film that you're currently in at the moment, which has been recently released, and you're starring in it with Kate Nash, is Coffee Wars. And when we were speaking to Kate last week, it triggered an interesting conversation, actually, because we talked about female entrepreneurship, which is a theme throughout the film, but also how actually Kate started talking about how the music industry differs quite a lot from the film and TV industry. And she was saying things like the film and TV industry has kind of more things around kind of maximum legal working hours and kind of more protection from financial exploitation. Whereas musicians are potentially more likely to be at risk of sharks or being stolen from, which she was, which she talked about on the podcast. Given that you cross both of those worlds, so your kind of career covers both of those, what do you think the music industry could learn from the film industry to protect its people, and maybe vice versa?
That's a really good question. I don't know a lot about how many kind of musician unions there are or how little there are, but I don't think there are as many as there are in acting. In acting, there's quite a lot of things that protect you. There's a lot of rules and legalities that make sure us artists or actors are not overworked and that we're generally in a safe situation. I don't think the same thing really applies or exists in music, or certainly not as much so. So I would say that would be quite an important thing.
Why do you think that is? What's they're so closely, knitted together in those industries. For the person who really doesn't understand, like myself listening to this, what's stopping that happening?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I can't really comment on that too much, only because I don't really know what does and doesn't exist. But I guess I feel like I'd say that in terms of instead of, let's say, your safety physically, because I don't know about that side of things, what I would say is that there's less protection, or that you need more protection in music if you're creating your music and it could be stolen, or you could be ripped off. That's your baby, that's yours. You're not being employed for the day to come in terms of, if you're the artist, you're not being employed to come in and sing other people's songs and you get paid and you walk away. If you're the artist, it's your music, and so therefore I would say that in acting, whereas us actors, if that's all we do, we're not writers or directors, but if we're just actors, we don't really ever have to worry about kind of our ideas being stolen or us being ripped off. And in music you do. So I would say that, some legal counsel of any kind, really, someone that you respect, is vital in music if you want to write your own music and you intend on kind of getting it out there. Before working with anyone, really, that's always important.
One of the things that's always interesting, so, we have a lot of us, say, like young listeners or young or emerging artists as musicians. And I always think it's a really interesting thing when people start to get recognized, and actually how at the first part that can be really flattering and really nice. But then actually it can look actually quite an unhealthy thing to actually be receiving end of. I wonder, from your perspective, obviously your sister Florence is the Oscar nominated actress. You've worked with some amazing people. Your career's gone through the roof as well. What advice would you give around that kind of topic, and how to navigate being recognised and how to keep on an even keel? Because it's a strange thing for young musicians to be on the receiving end of.
I would say something that I talk about with people quite a lot. I would say be aware that if you're going to find some level of success, and that's if you want to be successful as a musician or an actor, keep in your mind and be aware that there's a very high likelihood that you will be well known and famous before you're wealthy. And so how well you're known will come first before you have any money. And so there's going to be a weird blurred area where you want to go on holiday to, I don't know, somewhere that you normally spend not that much money to go to or whatever, or maybe, I mean, all your money, obviously, but you're going to basically go to where you normally go on holiday, and you are not bearing in mind that you're going to probably want to have some, lots of privacy, and you could end up sitting on your normal flight that you go somewhere, and everyone knows who you are, and people think you're suddenly a millionaire, and actually it hasn't quite caught up yet. I think I say this because most people have social media, we all have a camera phone, and stuff spreads so easily now. And so when people, I haven't fortunately yet had to experience this on a tough level, but if you think about, for example, something like a Netflix show or a Netflix film, and let's say you're a young actor and you land one of these roles and you get paid for it, and because it's film and TV, it's a leading role, you probably get paid, you know, quite well. But when that thing does well, if it does on Netflix, and it's seen by in 100 countries by, I don't know, 150 million people or 200 million people, I can imagine, and I've experienced it through other people, that that must be quite a shock. Because it's like, it's just me. It's me, Toby, who did 6 months of filming on that thing, and nothing's changed. Luckily, I've got some financial security, a little bit, because I did that work for 6 months, and then it comes out, and suddenly everyone in the world knows who you are, and you're still just you, you know. And so I would say that's something for people to be aware of. There is, more often than not, there is this weird kind of blurred area where this weird kind of crossover where you're more well known than you are.
Remunerated.
Yes, correct.
Do you know what? No one's ever answered that before, and that is such a good point, and that is absolutely the truth.
You can't, and it can be very hard for people to escape it. You see, you know, you see people. So many people are so upset and they're traumatized by whether it's paparazzi or press or people or fans. Because at first it's sweet and it's lovely, but if you can't escape it, that's a really terrifying thing. If you can't run away from it, there's nowhere for you to hide, you know, apart from the flat that you've always been in, and now it's so accessible to people because it's right there on the street. And do you know what I mean? So that's why I say it.
So let's talk Coffee Wars. So really interesting, thought-provoking concept for a film, and to touch on interesting ideas for those who haven't heard of it or know of the film. Toby, tell us what the premise is of it and your role.
The premise of Coffee Wars is Jo Hansen, Kate Nash, is a cafe owner, and she's a vegan cafe owner. She comes from a dairy eating and drinking family, a family that has a farm. And she is a vegan cafe owner in London trying to spread the word on dairy-free milks and veganism in general, but she's trying to do it through coffee, her love of coffee. And there are such things, for those who do not know this, there are barista championships, and you should Google them because they're just quite amazing. I had no idea that they existed until I got sent the script. And so Jo Hansen, Kate Nash, enters into the kind of barista championships, trying to take on the coffee world by storm with her oat milk, I guess you could say. And I play Rudy, who is a completely nuts, dairy guzzling, meat eating kind of psychopath who basically has one aim, it seems, in life, or at least for the duration of this movie, which is to destroy Jo Hansen and her company and her cafe. So we have a wonderful ensemble in this movie. I'm incredibly proud of it. We have comedic geniuses from the likes of Hugh Dennis and Sally Phillips. We have Freddie Fox, Jordan Stevens, Saoirse Monica Jackson, Kate, obviously. The list goes on. And it was a huge amount of fun making it. I'd wanted to do comedy professionally for more of it for a long time. And I don't think I realized how much I craved that until I was on set doing this. And I had, for the first time in any film or TV show, I never once kind of thought, oh, it's been quite a long day or whatever, because we just laughed for 2 months solid.
And how, you've obviously got very interesting dynamic as characters between yours and Kate Nash's character. Was that something that you worked on, or was it, did you bring your individual kind of characters as they were in the script together, or was it something you tried to work on kind of in between scenes or in rehearsals, so to create that kind of interesting dynamic between the two?
I'd say we found it on the scripts is very funny. The two characters, it's very clear what their motives are and their relationship to each other. But I think we found it on set. We had such a laugh that a lot of the time we'd come off set, we wouldn't, cameras would not be rolling, and we were still in our characters telling each other to, you know, whatever. So it's actually still, when I see Kate, we still very much kind of dip into characters, and we clearly enjoy it. So it kind of became, you know, several weeks of us just always, you know, being silly.
Awesome. It's an amazing cast. And what was your kind of fondest memories of filming, you know, through the, how long did you film for? I guess it was a few months, right? Or was it quite
a few weeks?
A few weeks.
I think for Kate, it was about 9 weeks or so, and it was a little bit less for me.
What are your fondest memories looking back, apart from just the laughs? What did you develop, you know, as a performer in that time?
I loved the physicality of that character. I loved really playing with kind of like a kind of a slapstick level of comedy and spinning on the soles of my feet, and, you know, being quite flamboyant at times, and I just really enjoy playing with the comedy with everyone was so sharp and so on their game that it was just a really, really wonderful and insightful experience for me as an actor, because I'd never done this before, not since I was at school, but, you know, that was in a school play. This was like, what? Like, this is my job? This is amazing. I get paid. I'm getting paid to do this, to screw around and to, you know, to kind of make, do little jumps and squeal and laugh. And yeah, I'd say that the entire experience was hugely joyful and happy.
When you were reading the script and thinking what this might look like as a film, how did it differ, the end product, when you went to the premiere, or you kind of got that cut through before, you know, before it was released, to what you thought it was going to be as a script? Because, you know, you got your imagination when you're looking at the script, right? And then the final product. In which ways did it differ?
I'd say that every single character, there was like an extra 30 or 40% energy than how I'd read those characters on the page. I found it tremendously funny reading it. And I think that the people that played every character just basically milked the jokes much as possible. So everything was just exaggerated. It's like everything was like a caricature version of what I wrote on the page. So it just made it even more bright and punchy, that's what I'd say.
Nice. Cool. So we'll begin to wrap up. I mean, a question that I ask every guest on the podcast about the music industry is, if you were president of the music industry for one day, what laws would you bring in to maybe make the industry more fair or equitable? What would you do to change the music industry in some way?
I think so often I hear of horror stories of people that have once signed a contract that they thought was fine. They were promised by someone that had been looked over, and only to find out years later that maybe something's been stolen from them, or the amount of the percentages that they've given over are just ludicrous. I would say, if there was a rule, if I was the president of the music industry, I'd probably make it illegal for any contract to be signed without any legal counsel having looked at it.
Great answer.
That's what I'd say.
Great answer. And given there's a lot of young musicians listening to this, what underrated skill or overlooked skill sometimes do you think every musician should have? So not just kind of, you know, being able to play your instrument or perform the way you want to, but what do you think is a really underrated skill every musician should have that's going to equip them to do well in the music industry?
Well, it's kind of, there's two, I'd say, that kind of go hand in hand. One is be open-minded. If you're going to talk about your career and decisions you need to make, be open-minded, and then at the same time have an equal, lovely balance of trusting your gut. So, you know, if you really feel like something's wrong, you really don't like a session that you're doing, you really don't want to work with this person again or continue or listen to someone's advice, don't do it. But at the same time, if it's just a case of, if you're kind of saying no to something, or you're going to maybe not do something because you're not quite sure about something, just because maybe it's something that you haven't tried before, you know, like the whole point, I think, is that we want to learn. If we want to do music forever, or you want to do anything in the arts forever, it'd be really great to have a long career, have longevity. And I think to do that, you have to just keep on learning. And that takes a level of open-mindedness.
Nice. If your house was burning down and everyone was safe that you cared about, what's a piece of memorabilia or something to do with music you'd grab?
I'd take my Spanish flamenco acoustic guitar that I have had since I was 12.
Tell us about the relationship you have with that guitar.
I started playing guitar in Spain when I was about eight. And I had a guitar. The only lessons we could get were with a Spanish flamenco guitar player, teacher. I didn't learn that per se, but it meant that that's the person that inspired me, and that's the type of guitar that I decided to play as well. And so I have I had a guitar that was by a guitar maker called Valeriano Bernal, which is what Paco de Lucía used to play. And then when I was about 12, I got another guitar, very beautiful guitar. And I basically kind of got some birthday money, and I'd spoken to my parents about selling the first one, we can maybe get another one. And this guitar it's kind of like grown with me. It's there are other guitars that probably sound better, but it's special to me. It's been all over the world with me, and I trust it. I feel like I've played a lot live. I've played a lot in the studio with this guitar. It's the head of the guitar snapped once, which was horrible. It's been fixed. The one of the tuning pegs came off and had to be replaced. And one of the things on the piece of, bone that goes just above the head that the strings rest on, that was once fell off and had to be replaced. But the guitar is there, and it's got its bruises and it's got its cracks and scratches. But I feel kind of at one with that guitar. So
it's that guitar that whenever you pick up another guitar, the strings don't feel the right distance from the fretboard, right? Because your reference point is always this Spanish guitar, right? Yeah.
Yeah. And when people pick up this guitar, they go, oh God, it's quite hard to play. It's quite wide. Whereas for me, that guitar, regardless of how perfect it is sonically, I would say that I will always play better on that guitar. Even if it's like whatever level it is, and then if I played a £20,000 or a £10,000 guitar, I'll play better on this one because I know it, And I also think that I'm a firm believer that guitars that have been played are guitars that will sound better. So if guitars have been loved and nurtured and have been around with you and you played it, thousands of times, it's going to sound better than something that's bought straight off the rack.
Yeah, yeah. So as we record this, you're halfway through the tour and Coffee Wars has just come out. What's the rest of the year got in line for you? What are you hoping, what are you planning for the rest of the year and hoping it comes about?
So we've got two more shows, then there'll be a couple of singles over the summer with an album coming out shortly afterwards, or my album. A few more shows for Christmas. Hopefully we'll see a nice increase in capacity in the venues, which is always great. And aside from that, I've got a film that I'm doing in June for a few weeks. And I think I'll start with that stuff.
Nice one. Well, listen, good luck with the rest of the shows this week. And
thank you
for your insight, kind of your reflective thinking and the advice for musicians out there. It's, you've got an unbelievable voice that I've enjoyed listening to over the last
couple of
weeks.
Thank you so much. That's very sweet.
Honestly, it's stunning what you can achieve with your voice. And look forward to hearing more of that in the future. And thanks for being such a great guest on the Stage Left podcast.
Chris, thank you so much for having me. It's been a lot of fun. Waiting if you wait.
For more episodes featuring comedian Stuart Lee, Tony Visconti, Gem Archer of Oasis, David Bowie bassist Gail Ann Dorsey, Queen's musical director Spike Edney, The Police manager Miles Copeland III, Kate Nash, Ian Brody, Stormzy producer Fraser T. Smith, Katie Cole with The Smashing Pumpkins, Clive Deamer of Radiohead, and Richard Fortus of Guns N' Roses, go to thestagelightpodcast.com and drop us a DM on Instagram, Facebook or Twitter to let us know what your biggest takeaway was from each interview. Search The Stage Left Pod and you'll find us.